Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a very sensitive alcoholic. I am. This is the kind of meeting I like, where there are too many alcoholics for the size of the room. I love it when alcoholics are jammed together. When they jam, no matter how big the room is, if it's too small, that's the ideal size. And you jam alcoholics together, they generate a great deal of love and a lot of energy, and it's love. And you've heard a lot tonight, this weekend, about what a wonderful weekend this has been up to this point, and all the work that has gone in to do that, and how. And that is a tremendous amount of work, and it is great that you're here. But it isn't the size, really, so much, and the number of you, as much as it is your attitude. I've never been to an AA event that has better attitude than what I see here today. And to me, attitude is just about everything. And as I see it, God creates reality, and I create my attitude toward his reality. And at the end of the day, it usually turns out that my attitude is more important than the reality. So what I'm saying is, in case you missed the point, is God and I are co-creators of my day, and my job is more important than his. Actually, I'm very humble. It may not have sounded that way. I know I'm humble because some guy told me I was humble. He said, "You're very humble." He says, "You've never used any that you were born with." And being married to Max, you have to be humble. I know that. Now you Al-Anon, stop the booing. That's it. I know the Al-Anons are here. I know. I can feel the vibrations. So, I used to say I'm glad to see the Al-Anons at AA meetings. I'm glad to see them at any meetings. No, they do. They need all the meetings they can get. But I used to make Al-Anon jokes, but I don't anymore. I mean, I decide Al-Anon jokes are like ethnic jokes. I mean, that after all, they're our greatest friends. I mean, nobody wants to see us sober more than they do. And I shouldn't even say they, because I go to Al-Anon every Monday noon. I go to Al-Anon with Max, and Max comes to AA with me, and we have two little Owl dogs, Lily and Sabrina, and they come to both our meetings. They come to both. They come to more meetings than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. And they have nicer personalities than a lot of people that are trying to stay sober. Max is. I know you're much too intelligent to believe that stuff Max was saying. It could have been worse. She could have told her dumb Al-Anon joke. She has a really dumb Al-Anon joke. She says it explains release with love, or detachment. That's her personal opinion. I'll tell you how dumb a joke is. She said it was about a woman who, back when tickets were hard to get for Phantom of the Opera, this woman was at a Saturday matinee of the Phantom of the Opera, and another woman came in and sat down beside her, and there was an empty seat between them. And they got to talking, and the second woman said to the first woman, "Isn't it a shame that this seat is empty when tickets are so hard to get?" And the woman said, "Well, that belonged to my husband." And the other woman said, "Well, where is he? And she said, well, he died. And the second one, oh, well, that's too bad. But couldn't you have gotten a relative or a friend or somebody to take the ticket? And the first woman said, they're all at the funeral. I told you there were a lot of Al-Anons in the room. You wouldn't get that much laughter at a strictly AA meeting like that. I don't tell jokes. I can't remember. I can remember any joke, but if I remember a new joke, I have to give up one of the old ones. I can only remember the real old ones, like the two alcoholics looking in the casket at the third alcoholic who had died, and one saying to the other, doesn't Joe look good now that he quit drinking? I remember a poem though. You look like the cultural type who would appreciate a poem, and it's a good alcoholic poem. It was how did it go? The whiskey was spilled on the bar room floor, and the bar was closed for the night. A little gray mouse crept out of his hole to dance in the pale moonlight. He lapped up the whiskey on the barroom floor, and back on his haunches he sat. And all night long you could hear him roar, bring on that god darn cat. So anyhow. I enjoyed the countdown. I enjoyed the countdown, but somehow that didn't do do justice to my length of sobriety. The last day of this month, this is July, the last day of this month, it'll be Max's natal birthday. It'll be my 28th AA birthday. And that's nothing. You're nowhere near. You're nowhere near as impressed as I am. 28 years is the longest I have ever gone without a drink. Yeah. 28 years is a long time between drinks for me. I've never gone that long without a drink. Yeah. As a matter of fact, there's a significance to it being 28 years, too, in that the end of this year, December 2nd of this year, Max and I will have been married 56 years. Wow, he's right, by God. Yeah. You're nowhere near as impressed as I am. Well, what it means is that for 28 years, she drove me to drink. And for 28 years, I've been sober. I'm looking forward to see what the next 28 years is going to bring. But that's the way it is in AA. We just don't drink. I found that out in AA. We don't drink. We just don't drink. We don't drink, no matter what happens. We don't drink, no matter what doesn't happen. Yeah. We just don't drink. I mean, we don't even drink when we deserve a drink. We don't even drink when we want to drink. Yeah. We just don't drink. It's an AA. That's the kind of a We just don't drink. In fact, we're kind of noted for not drinking. I haven't even had an occasional drink. I haven't even had a social drink. In fact, I think if I'd had even an occasional drink once in a while, I don't think I'd be standing here with 8 years. No, we just don't drink. And it took me a while to find that out. Anyhow, I'm glad to be here, and I'm glad to be an alcoholic. I like being an alcoholic. I love being an alcoholic. This is the best life I've ever known. I thoroughly enjoy being an alcoholic. I love being an alcoholic. But bothers you to hear me say that? That's just too damn bad. If you don't understand it, talk to your sponsor. If he doesn't understand it, get another sponsor. Yeah. It's kind of like, I didn't hear her say it, but I heard the gal who said that she used to drink for the fun of it. She used to drink for the fun of it. She had so much fun drinking that drinking got to be a habit. And she drank out of habit until the drinking got so bad she had to go to AA. And she went to AA because she had to until it got to be a habit. Now she goes for the fun of it. I come to AA for the fun of it. And I love being an alcoholic. And it's surprising that I enjoy it so much because I was never meant to be an alcoholic. That's true. I became an alcoholic by mistake. I was never meant to be an alcoholic. I didn't even look like an alcoholic. Except sometimes when I'm drinking. My mother never said, "Why don't you grow up to be president of AA?" No school counselor ever said, "What about being an alcoholic? They have a lot of fun. You want to be an alcoholic?" Never occurred to me that it would be a good idea to be an alcoholic. Okay? I had a brain tumor. That's what the trouble was, and Max was making fun of me today. But I did. I mean, after all, people say, "What kind of medicine do you practice?" I was an internist. I was a diagnostician. I was a specialist in diagnosis. When other doctors couldn't figure out what was wrong with somebody, they'd send them to me, and I'd do a history and a physical and lab work and some consultations, and I'd give them a diagnosis. I was an expert diagnostician, and I could see that I was sick. I was losing weight, and I had this sense of impending insanity, and I had daily headaches, and I had convulsions twice, and I thought, boy, I need a good medical workup, and I need to see a good diagnostician. I happened to be the best diagnostician I knew at the time. So I did some lab work on me, and I did some physical exam, and I stood in front of the mirror, and I had a consultation with me. It was obvious to me. I had a brain tumor. And I would die, and you'd all be sorry, by God. Oddly enough, I was going to the best neurologist in Orange County, and he was treating me for epilepsy with Dilantin and phenobarbital. He didn't think to ask me if I drank, and I didn't think to tell him. And he didn't know why I was having convulsions, and neither did I. And I ended up going back to the Mayo Clinic, and that's where I've been sending Max to these different psychiatrists, and you got all the Al-Anon, some of the. I sent her to three or four different psychiatrists. Our kids were going to clinical psychologists. I thought that was kind of classy and modern and hip. Professional person getting professional help for their sick family. And the only thing that made me mad was that the dog, she was bringing the dog home with psychiatric diagnoses. And that bothered me, that the she would give the impression to this vet that our dog was neurotic. And I remember getting mad at her one time. I said, what do you mean the dog just needs more love? I said, you tell that stupid cat and dog doctor, he's not a Beverly Hills psychiatrist. All I want to know is, why does the dog wet in my lap when I'm holding him? Oddly enough, that dog hasn't wet my pants since I joined AA. And neither have I. I was doing everything I could to help Max. And the harder I worked on her case, the sicker she got. I wasn't surprised when it ended up at the nut ward. But when that steel door slammed shut and she was the one that went home, I was amazed. Yeah. I didn't like it there. But the bad part was, it was Christmas time. Don't go to the Mayo Clinic nut ward at Christmas time, because they make you ice Christmas cookies. I hate the ice Christmas cookies. I remember the nurse came to my cell and took me by the hand and took me down to the Christmas cookie icing party. And we steer my hand into the icing and we smash it onto a cookie. And I don't know how many cookies we crumbled before I told her what she could do with her cookies. I demanded my constitutional right to go back to my cell, by God. I don't like icing, but I never liked icing. When I was a kid, my older sister had a thing about Christmas cookies. She would make all kinds of Christmas cookies, angels and trees and Santas and deers and Christmassy cookies, and all different colors of icing, and then lots of sprinkles and stuff you put on it. And then we'd have a Christmas cookie icing contest to see who could ice the prettiest Christmas cookie. And I hated to ice Christmas cookies when I was a little kid back in Alliance, Ohio. And I hated to have a Christmas cookie icing party when I was a big shot doctor on the nut ward of the Mayo Clinic. And I knew how to get out of a place like that. I signed out. Of course, I had to get Max to countersign my insanity to get out. They won't let you out on your own recognizance, as they say in court. And she wasn't being very cooperative. So I had to threaten her a little bit, but I finally intimidated her and she signed it. We got back, back to California, where they treat me with more respect. And ended up seeing the psychiatrist there, and he locked me up in the local nut ward. Locked me up in the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And the waiting room was right, the big glass bay windows on the waiting room, and the main walk into the main room of the library was, or into the hospital, walked right by that big window. And they wanted you to sit there in the day room and spend your time there. And I could just see, I could visualize my patients walking by and looking, oh, there's my friendly neighborhood internist in the nut ward, yeah. I wonder when he'll be out so we can get an appointment. Yeah. And one of the reasons I had to spend so much time in the nut ward is because the only other thing they had for you to do in the nut ward was to make leather belts. God, they were fanatics on leather belts. They really, it was a part of their philosophy. I don't think you could ever get out of there until you made a leather belt. I mean, they felt you just couldn't make it in the world out there if you couldn't make a leather belt. And they were real nags about it. I didn't like it at all. I told them. I said, I don't understand. I have a wall. I have a wall that has papers and diplomas and licenses and certificates that prove that I've been educated way beyond my level of intelligence. And I don't see how learning how to make leather belts would improve my life in any... I didn't understand the philosophy. Not only did I not understand the philosophy, I didn't understand the instructions. That wasn't my fault. That was the fault of that dumb occupational therapist. Because I've always known that if you don't know a thing well enough, you can explain it to me so that I know it, then you don't know it as well as you're supposed to. And she had explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. And I thought I didn't have much to do in the way. I remember sitting there in the nut or commiserating with myself about the series of mistakes, misdiagnoses, and bad medical management, and bad breaks, and things that had gone wrong, that a nice guy like me had ended up in a place like that. And this dumb psychiatrist who couldn't understand that my problems were strictly marital walked up behind me and asked me if would I mind talking to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous. And I thought, God almighty, Doc, don't I have enough problems of my own without trying to help some drunk from AA? But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on a nut ward is having a happy psychiatrist. And I was willing to go to any length to make him happy. And so I said yes. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room yelling, "My name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic. Ha 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 ha." I felt sorry for him. He is meeting a perfect stranger, and the only thing he can think of about to introduce himself is that he's an alcoholic. And I was a lot more impressed when I found out he was an attorney. And had a loud voice, a loud voice. My God, he had a loud voice. And he told his story. And I don't know anything about his story except that it was loud and long. And I know how it ended. It ended. I know the final words of his story was, he says, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to meet you tonight. Would you like to go along?" And I said, "Hell no, I won't like it. But I'll go." Because I figured he'd go back and squeal to that dumb psychiatrist. And I'm sure he would have. Took me off to a meeting. I've heard some wonderful talks about people's first meeting. The profundities they heard, who read and who led and who prayed and who talked and all that stuff. And I don't know anything. I don't know anything. I don't even know what meeting. I don't know how many meetings we went to before I knew what meeting we were at. I don't know anything about my first meeting, but I do know it had a profound effect. It had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. Psychiatrist was delighted, and he was really interested in my case now. He had been ignoring me. Now he's real interested. He spent a lot of time with me. He asked all kinds of questions. Said, "What's this about a book?" He says, "What's this about steps?" He says, "What are the kind of meetings do they have? How often are you going to go to meetings?" And all these questions. I thought, oh my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. Yeah. And he's ashamed to go, so he's sending me. You know. So I was anxious to get Frank to take me to as many meetings as he could. And Frank was very good about it. He took us every day, except he wasn't sure about Friday. Friday, he wasn't sure. He thought he might have a date with Carolyn. And I thought, well, that's a hell of a way to run an organization. And I reported him to the psychiatrist. And the psychiatrist got another attorney to take me on Friday night. And finally got enough brownie points, and I got discharged from the hospital. I had no intentions of going back. Why would I go back? I wasn't an alcoholic. But then the other thing I found out was that Max liked the meetings. And once I found that out, I decided I wasn't going to go to meetings anymore if she didn't behave right. And yourself. In fact, have you ever tried that? Have you tried sitting at home on a Saturday night drinking when your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? Yeah. I found it boring. I had to go back to meetings to find out what the alcoholics were laughing about. And I went there and I found out they'd laugh at anything. They laugh at nothing. One night I found myself laughing with him, and I haven't had a drink since. Yeah, it took 7 months. 7 months. So I went to apparently one meeting too many. Went to one last meeting, laughed, and that was it. That's how I got to be an alcoholic. That's not funny. That's very dangerous. I mean, there are people here in the audience who are not alcoholics. And I want to tell you, you are the ones who are at great risk. I had grown up being taught that the way you became an alcoholic was by drinking alcohol in bars. I didn't get alcoholism drinking alcohol. I got drunk drinking alcohol. My alcoholism is a contagious disease. You get it from other alcoholics. It is. It's a virus. The virus goes in through your ears. And it affects your brain. And it's incurable. And it's terminal. It's serious. And you get it in places like this. And the fact that you saw here tonight, how many alcoholics there are in the room. You know, the place is really loaded with alcoholics. I've always been impressed with the number of alcoholics that you see at AA meetings. I mean, I do that anyway at home. We always say, look, can we see the hands of the alcoholics? And they'll put up their hands. Someone will put up two hands. They'll wave, you know. They'll think it's real funny to be an alcoholic. You know? I think it's a big damn deal, you know. Yeah. Try that in a bar sometime. You know? Yeah. I don't think they'll think you're very damn funny. Yeah. There are no alcoholics in the bars. Yeah. All the alcoholics are at the AA meetings. Yeah. So if you're here tonight, you're not an alcoholic. If you're here this weekend, you're not an alcoholic. Be very careful what you listen to. Keep your mind wide open. Keep it wide open so whatever goes in goes right on through. So if you hear something and you think, oh my goodness, I felt like that when I did something like that, you suppose I might feel, boom, you're an alcoholic. Once you suspect it, it's too late. I mean, from then on, all it does is get worse. It never gets better. You know? Not only does it get worse at that point, but it gets worse even when you're not drinking. When I first became an alcoholic, at that one meeting too many on the 7 months, I was just a little bit alcoholic. Just almost just a heavy drinker. But no, just barely alcoholic. Almost a non-alcoholic. Very mild alcoholic. But the trouble is, because I was an alcoholic, in order to keep from, because I was going to be a sober alcoholic if I'm going to be an alcoholic, somebody said stick with the winners. I couldn't find out what a winner was, so I decided rather than try to stick with one, I tried to be one. I'm going to be a successful member of AA. Well, I find that winners in AA, successful members of AA, I haven't found any who drink. So I thought, well, I better not drink. The only way I could keep from drinking was to go to more meetings. But the more I go to meetings, I keep getting reinfected. And now, 28 years later, I am much more alcoholic than I was when I first became it. When they say it's a progressive disease, they're not kidding, boy. It is progressive. The nice part about it is not only is the disease progressive, but so is sobriety. So is sobriety. Sobriety is just a little more progressive than the disease, and it keeps getting better and better. But I'm a lot more alcoholic than I was. Even have a bit of a pill problem. This is an AA meeting, so we won't talk about that. But I owe a little debt of gratitude to. I'm sure none of you know about these, but I do know a shred of debt of gratitude to amphetamines. I don't know if I'd have had this stamina to have completed my pre-AA training period if it hadn't been for amphetamines. I took a few pills, but I never ever took a pill unless I had the precise symptom. I had the precise symptom that only that pill would relieve. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. And so that, so every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time. Taken according to directions and prescribed by a doctor. Me. Today I don't drink and I don't take pills, and as a result I don't have any problems that are the result of drinking or taking pills. I didn't say I didn't have any problems, I just don't have any problems just the result of drinking. My problems are all due to any problem, all problems, every problem, any problem I have today is a result of my thinking, not my drinking. In fact, my sponsor says to me, he says, Paul, don't drink and don't think. And every problem I have today is a thinking problem. In fact, some time back I even got the looking at the 20 questions about drinking and thinking. Have you ever done that? It's an old idea. I used to carry the 20 questions around. The 20 questions where if you say yes to one, you better be cautious about being alcoholic. If you say yes to two, you're probably alcoholic. And if you say yes to three, you're very likely an alcoholic. If you substitute the word thinking for drinking, you get some really stupid questions. Like, for instance, do you lose time from work due to your thinking? Is your thinking making your home life unhappy? Have you ever felt remorse after thinking? Have you gotten into financial difficulty as a result of your thinking? Do you crave a think at a definite time daily? Be careful of this one. Do you want to think the next morning? This is a stupid one. Does your thinking cause you to have difficulty in sleeping? Is your thinking jeopardizing your job or business? Do you think to escape from worries or trouble? Do you perhaps think alone? Have you ever had a complete loss of memory as a result of thinking? Not since the last time I passed the freeway off-ramp. You can't all answer yes to this one, but I can. Has your physician ever treated you, or have you ever been in a hospital or institution on account of your thinking? Anyhow, welcome to the fold. In fact, it isn't what happens to me in life, it's what I think about. It's not even what I think, it's what the people in my head think. I got a room full of personalities in my head. And the way I think is by they talk to me. They talk to me. They're up there and they talk to me. They talk and they talk and they talk and they talk. I was going to say, if I'm awake, they're talking. If I'm asleep, they're talking. They talk. That's all they do. They talk. They never do any work. They just talk. And talk 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 and talk. That's all they talk. And my life depends on who of the ones that are talking I listen to. And it's not what happens so much as what they say, who I listen to, but what they're passing judgment on everything that happens. It's the committee, and even my relationship with Max. It isn't so much what she does that determines our relationship. It's what the people in my head say about what she does. And it's not even what they say, it's who I choose to listen to of the people that are up there. Because they're opposing things. There are a lot of opposing voices up there, And I didn't know I had a choice as to who to listen to. I mean, it's sometimes it's more obvious than others. I mean, like now, I'm trying to talk to you, and you're sitting there very quietly, and I'm trying to have some focus to what I'm saying and some trend along a certain line. And there'll be one of them will say, "Why don't you talk about blah, 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 blah?" And another one will say, "Well, yeah, but no, why don't you talk about something else over here?" And I'll say, "Well, what, no, then let me talk about this there." And then they get to fighting among themselves about whether or not they're fighting about that. And it gets very confusing for me to try to talk sense to you and all this chatter going on up there. And I think, "My God, shut up there," you know. And they all shut up, and I can't think of anything to say. Yeah. And it's the same way with Max. I mean, Max and I are entirely opposite. We're entirely opposite. I mean, we couldn't be more opposite. I mean, she likes TV. I don't like TV. I like to read. She doesn't like to read. I like things put away so I know where they are when I want them the next time. She enjoys the hunt. She doesn't. I like to put it away now. She'd rather put it away later. Later never comes. And she loves chaos. I'm working on a problem, I like to narrow it down to. So that I ask questions and narrow it down to a point. When I get to the point, I have a sense of direction, know what I want to do. The pyramid. I think vertically. She drinks horizontally. She thinks horizontally. That was a Freudian slip. I drink horizontally. Yeah. She thinks horizontally. I mean, it's hard to have a good communication when you're vertical and they're horizontal. I will try to narrow it down a little bit, and I'll spend 10, 15 minutes, maybe a whole day, trying to figure out how to ask the question so that she can only answer it yes or no. I'll finally figure it out, and I'll ask the question, and she'll say, "Well, we can't do it that way." And I said, "I haven't even told you what we're going to do yet. You know, it's just impossible." It's like the old rabbi that somebody said to him, "How come you Jews always answer a question by asking a question?" And the rabbi says, "Why do you want to know?" It's just. Max and I are entirely opposite. We never. It's like it said many years ago, we never should have gotten married in the first place. But we've had to learn how to communicate. And what's really happened is that there's. What I found out is that there's a guy in of the committee up in my head who is obsessed with her. Really obsessed with her. Watches her. He's been watching her as long as she's been around. And sad to say, he doesn't really care that much for her. And so he loves to point out negative things. Like, did you notice the tone of voice in which she's talking to you? Yeah. Does that woman realize who she's talking to? Yeah. Yeah, there's another one up there just as obsessed with her, just as obsessed as she is, always watching her, always reporting back to me, and he thinks she's great. He thinks she's got a great Al-Anon program. He likes to remind me that she kept going to meetings when I wasn't going anymore. He thinks she has a great sense of humor, a great spiritual program. He keeps telling me how lucky I am to have her. And my relationship with Max doesn't depend on, I hate to keep saying this in front of her, doesn't depend so much on what she does. It depends on which of those two guys in my head I listen to about the interpretation of what she does. In fact, my whole day depends on who I listen to. The people in my head. Some of the things they say up there are just absolutely ridiculous. I mean, illegal and lewd. It's bad enough I have to listen to them. I'm sure glad you don't have to listen to them. It's terrible. But my day consists of who I listen to of all that. If I don't have a good day, it's because I've been listening to the wrong people. And it's very easy for me to do that. Now I found out that I don't have to do that. When they say, "Well, thank you for participating. If you'll sit down, we'll call in somebody else." Yeah. I have a meeting going on all the time. And I'm sure this is like that. I remember a priest working in the alcoholism field used to say, he knew that any time he was dealing one-on-one with an alcoholic, he knew he was automatically outnumbered. dealing with a whole committee up there. Anyhow, but one of the many interesting things about that is that in the center of all that confusion, well, I want to go back for a minute to this business about Max, and that was how long these two guys in my head have known her. They've known her since we were 4 years old. Oh my goodness, that's right. Yes, it's a long time, about 72 years as a matter of fact. What happened was when I was 4 years old, my father gave up a job, without even asking my opinion. He gave up his job in Canton, Ohio, and he bought a house drugstore combination in Alliance, Ohio. And I literally grew up in a drugstore where better living through chemistry was a way of life. Perhaps equally important, next door was where Grandma Genslein was raising this little orphan Genslein girl, and Grandma Genslein had this her granddaughter, and also the two sons, the Genslein boys. And the Genslein boys were alcoholics. They were all the time getting arrested and putting Alliance in the jail. And the Alliance Review would always say the Genslein boys would spend another night in jail as for common drunk. And as Max and I were growing up, my family was not very happy with me playing with the Genslein girl because they were afraid that eventually we might get married, and if I ever married into the Genslein family, I might turn out to be an alcoholic. And by God, they were right, you know. Most people don't know how they got to be alcoholic. I'm an alcoholic by marriage. I wasn't an alcoholic when I married her. But anyway, I found out that in the center of all this committee in my head, in contrast to all the noise that's going on up there in my head, in the very center of me, there's a center of absolute calm. The center of absolute calm. And that's where my higher power is. And that's where he's always been. But I didn't know that. And not knowing it was the same as it not being true. Because I couldn't make use of it. Now today I know that I can't go anywhere without taking my higher power with me. And that anywhere I go or anything I want to do, he's with me. I'm never alone. And that's a tremendous comfort. That's a tremendous comfort. Plus the fact that I have these steps and... In my length of whatever length of time sobriety I have, and the people I work with, I have never found a problem, either one of my own or one of somebody else's, such that there wasn't a satisfactory answer in the steps. So I have a program of answers to all problems, and I have my higher power with me wherever I go. And I find that a very comforting thing. It has a lot to do with why I just love being an alcoholic, because it's such a freedom. And in fact, when I heard somebody say it at a big round, a couple thousand people at a roundup, the gal was closing the meeting, and she said something about at the end of the meeting, instead of when we say the Lord's Prayer, instead of looking at the ground or closing your eyes, why don't you look in the eyes of other alcoholics? And I've gotten in the habit of doing that, and it's so common for my higher power to recognize the higher power in another person. And when that happens, it's hard to keep from smiling, and it's so much a part of our program. And and one other thought that along that line, Father Barney used to come down to our area and put on retreats for Alcoholics and Al-Anons. And he used to divide sobriety. He said it was like a baseball diamond. And he said first base was physical sobriety, second base was mental sobriety, third base was emotional sobriety, and home plate was spiritual sobriety. And I like that. I like that breaking it down. I like breaking things down, just like I like breaking sobriety down into one day at a time. I used to always quit drinking forever. And every time I quit drinking forever, I ended up drunk. And I finally decided quitting drinking was bad on my health. And I switched to this AA way of just not taking one drink. Just don't take one drink for one day. And I thought, well, I could do that. I could skip one drink for one day. And that's worked well for me. And same way with sobriety. I don't want just physical sobriety. I want all I can get out of this program. In fact, somebody was showing me a computer program which made graphs. You put data in the computer, run this program, and the program makes a graph. It'll make a pie graph or a bar graph, or a real clever thing. And I thought, well, if you had a real big computer and it made a graph of my life, what would it look like? And I decided that it would be a giant V, that my life started way, way over there, and it's going to end way, 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 way over there. and it jumped to a giant V. And from where it started until July 31st, 1967, my life was on a downhill course. Now, it wasn't a straight line down. It was up and down, up and down. Just enough ups to keep me confused. And when it went down, it was downer than it was the last time. And it went down until it ended up in the nut ward of the hospital I was on the staff of. And that wasn't bad enough. I had to go to AA. And after 7 months of AA, I accepted the fact that through some cosmic error or whatever, through some mistake, I was a mild alcoholic. And my life has been getting better and better and better ever since. And it's not a straight line up. Some days, some weeks, some years are better than others. But the trend is up. The trend is up. And as far as I can tell, the only thing that determines how high that can go is how long I can stay around doing the things I'm doing that's keeping on an upward trend. And I just want all I can get out of this program. I can't live long enough to get all this program. I don't think anybody can ever live long enough to get all this program has to offer. But I want all I can get. I want all I can get. So I'm going to keep doing the things I'm doing that's keeping it on an upward trend. And even when it drops down, I know a lot of things I can do to get it back up. And even if I don't do anything, I know it's going to go back up. I know, because that's the only Bible quote I use. The Bible says, and it came to pass. The Bible doesn't say, and it came to stay. And what fascinates me is the point of that V. The point of that V. That one act of acceptance of the fact that I was a mild alcoholic, changed the course of my life. And I thought, if that act of acceptance could be that powerful, what would my life be like if I accepted every reality in my life? If I practiced total acceptance of God's will in all of my life? It's as though, it's what I could come to think of as the positive power of acceptance and the negative power of non-acceptance. As long as I refused to accept the reality of my life kept getting worse. And once I accepted that reality, it kept getting better and better and better. And it's as though when I resist reality, it gets worse. When I accept reality, it gets better. And anyhow, it's really changed the course of my life. It moved me from being a victim to being a hero in my own life story. It moved me from being a whiner to being a winner. And I just love being an alcoholic. I just love being an alcoholic. I can't say that I'm proud to be an alcoholic, because I don't know that had anything to do with it. I never decided to be an alcoholic. So I can't take any pride in something I had nothing to do with. So I can't be proud to be an alcoholic, but I'm certainly not ashamed of it. And I'm very, very, very proud to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I think that's absolutely tremendous. And I thank God for AA. I thank you for my sobriety. Thank you for sitting there in this heat. And I'm really glad to be here. I love you all. Thank you.